Welcome, Spartans, to Spartan Up Podcast, your resiliency partners. We are dedicated to getting you ripped off the couch and making you the best Spartan you can be.
We really are, Colonel.
We really are. I am Colonel Tim Nye, retired Army Colonel. To my right has got the founder and CEO, the legendary Joe DeSena.
Current active seed huntress, Sephra.
To my left is the seed huntress, Sephra. And we've got a great episode here today. I got the honor of interviewing Derek Fitzgerald a couple of weeks ago back in West Point. This guy is amazing, Joe. I don't know if you remember, I'm sure you do. Heart transplant Ironman. I think 16 Ironmans in the book after a heart transplant. So if you want to talk about grit, you want to talk about resiliency, this is the guy that's going to get you motivated.
Over time, I was able to get enough muscles to wiggle my body out of bed, fall to the floor, and army crawl across the floor until I hit a vertical surface, push my face up a wall, and then stagger. And that's how I started training for Ironman.
That's incredible.
Yeah.
So we're going to go off. We're going to hear what he's got to say. We're going to come back, chew it up a little bit, and hopefully you'll enjoy this episode.
Yeah, it's a really amazing one.
Today on the interview, it's my privilege, my pleasure to introduce you to Derek Fitzgerald. We're here at West Point, right on the outskirts of West Point, actually in Highland Falls, beautiful downtown Highland Falls. West Point, or United States Military Academy, is right around the corner. And behind me, over my shoulder, maybe you can see the West Point Museum. And over here is a beautiful visitor center. If you get a chance, come by and visit that. Really, really a nice place inside. But anyway, as I said, I am here today with Derek. Derek's got a fascinating story. I really want you guys to hear about it. But basically, a guy who was a little out of shape, a little overweight, cancer survivor, stricken with cancer, fights back all the way to become an Ironman. Is that in a nutshell?
That's a rough nutshell, yeah.
All right. Well, let's now get into some specifics then.
Okay.
So give me a little bit of your background and your history.
Grew up playing soccer up through high school, was in the marching band. I was just average kid. I wasn't a sick kid at all. Didn't spend a lot of time worrying about whether or not, you know, I was sick or not. And I just went about my business. I went through college. And coming out of college, I went straight into work, focused on my career, and forgot about taking care of myself physically. Yeah. And basically ballooned upwards north of 200 pounds.
Okay.
From probably 145 to 200 plus. And then around 2003, I was visiting family in Virginia and realized I was having some issues. Went to the doctor.
And how old were you around there?
Around 30 years old.
About 30 years old, okay.
And went to the doctor after 3 months of basically sticking every probe down and up they possibly could. They opened me up with surgery and they said, Derek, we found a grapefruit-sized tumor in your intestine. You have cancer.
Wow. And how do you take that news? How do you process that?
Me, I don't look too far ahead. You know, I mean, a lot of people can look at that as a momentous or a mountainous undertaking.
Right.
And I just said, what's the next step, Doc?
Okay. So you faced it head on. I know that at least I had some cancer issues within my family. So I've got some experience, nothing. I'm not trying to equate them. I'm just saying, you know, for some people, it is, you know, it's kind of a spiral, dark hole, depth kind of, and other people just kind of summon themselves right away and say, okay, I'm in a fight. What now? What am I supposed to do?
Well, it was good because they had been searching for quite some time and they were just ready to give up on all the search and say, well, you know what, you've got some weird symptoms. We can't explain them, but you're just gonna have to live with them for the rest of your life. Once they found cancer,
yeah,
I knew what I was up against and it was helpful.
It made it real. It made it something you could put a plan together, basically.
Put a plan around it and start acting on it.
Yeah. So what? Walk me through that then. Did you go downhill, obviously, and then before you started back up?
Well, yeah. What they did was they had cut me open, and they had introduced me to my oncologist right at that point. And they said, Derek, we've just severed your abdominals. You're gonna have to learn how to walk again.
Oh my God.
And you know, you've got to get strong enough for us to put you through chemotherapy.
Okay.
And once you get to there, then you're going to go through chemo. And that's what happened. I went to rehab. I learned how to walk again. I went to chemo and he said, listen, we're going to flood your body with toxins. to the point where we almost kill you, but the goal is to kill the cancer.
Right.
So it's to take you down as low as we possibly can. Hopefully we got all the cancer, and then we'll bring you back up.
And how long was that process?
That was 6 months.
6 months.
And then 3 months after that, I was declared in remission. 3 months after that, that's when I started having troubles breathing.
And what was that from?
Well, I spent several nights in the ER. First, they thought it was pneumonia. Then they thought it was pleurisy. Finally, a doctor comes to my bedside and he says, "Derek, I know you've had a tough year. I'm afraid I got some more bad news. You're now in heart failure." So
caused by the chemo or
by the chemo? Yeah.
Wow.
So
little side note. Chemo causes heart failure. Okay.
So yeah, there's a specific drug that damaged my heart, and basically they warned me about it going in, but they said honestly, we know more about hearts than we know about cancer.
Yeah. All right.
And so if we have to cross that bridge, we'll do that then. So they focused on the cancer, they saved my life from cancer, but in turn damaged my heart to the point where I went through 7 years of heart failure until...
What does that mean, 7 years of heart failure? What is...
Basically...
To a layman, I think your heart fails once, that's it. So how do you go through 7 years of failure?
There's something called ejection fraction. We all have it. It's the efficiency at which our heart pumps oxygenated blood through our system.
Okay.
Most people's ejection fraction is a normal EF is somewhere between 55 and 65%. When they found my heart failure, I was at 18%. And so I was having trouble breathing. I was having dizzy spells. I was hacking and coughing. It felt like a cold at first.
So you're bedridden this entire time, I imagine, or close to it? Or?
Not at first. I continued working. I continued doing what I was doing. But slowly but surely, over the course of those 7 years, I went from walking around talking with 30-second dizzy spells to being completely atrophied, completely bedridden, sleeping 23 hours a day, and unable to function.
That's got to be, though. So now, how do you maintain, or maybe you did or didn't, how do you maintain hope at that point? How do you... say, hey, I can still beat this, or is that what you were telling yourself?
I was just holding on, and
victory was just staying alive.
Victory was just staying alive. I didn't know from one day to the next if I would close my eyes, if I would open them again, and I just hoped. At a certain point, you go on the heart transplant waiting list, and you know you say that you know something either has to happen to make you better. Right. Or something has to happen in which you get worse. And the weird scenario when you go on a heart transplant waiting list is that the way organ donation works, the organs go to the sickest. So you're already sick, but you get
somebody worse off.
You have to hope to get as bad as you possibly can without dying.
Without going underneath that line, whatever that is. Well, flatline, I imagine.
Yeah, and I did that a couple times. So
seriously.
I died a couple times along the way. They brought me back. And then,
so let me. So you clearly aren't working.
I worked until August of 2010.
Wow. So what type of job did you have that you were able to?
I was traveling the country interviewing key thought leaders in oncology and cardiology.
Seriously. As part of your job.
As part of my job.
And which was what?
I had a technology company. I was helping pharmaceutical companies sell drugs.
Well, I mean, the odds of that is staggering to me.
Yeah, I was interviewing oncologists, and then I had no tie to cancer, and then I got cancer. My business expanded. We were interviewing cardiologists. I got heart failure. And then I told my partners that we weren't expanding in any other verticals.
Yeah, I wouldn't. Because, I'd be very, very careful the next step.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, don't invest in coffins or anything.
Right? Exactly, right?
Wow, that's incredible. All right, so you're gaining all of this knowledge. Mm. You obviously have some type of, I don't know, positive spirit, desire to live, obviously.
Sure.
So you get the heart transplant, I assume? You're standing there?
I got the heart transplant January 3rd, 2011.
2011.
And it's always a, you know, hope for the best, prepare for the worst scenario. You never know. Heart transplant is just a chance at life. And even the
surgery... Because it might not take?
Yeah. And so, you know, they opened the door a crack, and then it was my job to wedge my foot in that crack in that door and then just blow it open.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Make the most of that opportunity.
Absolutely,
right?
Yeah.
So you're given a second chance on life.
Yeah.
So you go from cancer, open heart surgery, to make the leap. What? How many years later are you crossing the finish line in an Ironman? And is it a full Ironman?
Well, let's see. I hadn't actually, well, first off, in January of 2011, I spent that month trying to lift my head an inch off the pillow. 8 months later, I did my very first in my whole life, 5K. 2 months after that, I did my first half marathon. So that was 2011. 2012 was my first marathon and my first Olympic distance triathlon. A month later, that was April. In May, I did my first half iron. Caught the bug and basically wanted the
workout bug, not another
the endurance
sick,
bug.
Not another
the
sickness.
Endurance bug, right. Exactly.
I worried about you getting sick again.
No. And basically, I wanted to enjoy the most of this latest round at life. I wanted to find a way to honor my donor. I didn't know how I was going to do that. This person, this stranger that saved my life.
And do you know anything about your donor?
I know
how
nothing.
How does that work? You do them?
It's set up like a close adoption.
Okay.
6 months after my transplant, I wrote my my donor family a thank you for my life.
Sure.
And I know that it goes through intermediaries. They redact anything that's
make sure it's right. Yeah.
They redact anything that would identify me personally.
Oh, that's true.
And I know they received it. I know they read it. But unless they choose to write back, I'll never know anything about them.
Just a quick sidelight here. Why do they do that? Why do they protect you? What is it that they're concerned about?
Well, they lost a loved one.
Right.
And there's a lot of emotions that surround that.
And you never know.
And, you know, sometimes people can come up to you and say, we lost our loved one. We lost our way of living. You owe us something, whether it's emotional or financial or whatever it is.
Right.
So there has to be some semblance of reintroduction and there has to be some kind of communication back and forth before the legal people say it's okay for us to meet.
All right. Well, I mean, that all makes sense. Again, thankfully, I have zero knowledge of any of this.
Of course.
I mean, so kind of just fascinated by that.
I wouldn't wish my story on anyone.
So physically, how do you do it? I mean, so, you know, I want to, you know, again, emotionally, spiritually, whatever, how you do it. But how do you start getting out of bed and starting to run a quarter mile or, you know, leading up to a 26-mile race? Or, you know, how do you will yourself through that?
You know, it's all in stages and it's all in intervals. But it's funny to think about where I was and where I got to. And when I started, I mentioned that I was spending January of 2011 just trying to lift my head an inch off of a pillow. I completely atrophied. And so over time, I was able to get enough muscles in my butt to wiggle my body out of bed, fall to the floor, and army crawl across the floor
until
I hit a vertical surface, push my face up a wall, stagger. And that's how I started training for Ironman.
That's incredible. And did you know that was your goal?
No.
So what was your goal?
My goal was to try and get a little bit stronger every day. I had no idea what was going to be possible for me on the far side of a heart transplant. As far as I knew, it was going to be sitting in a lazy boy watching TV all day.
Yeah.
And it didn't excite me. And so what I wanted to do was to get myself to a point that all of that was worth it.
So family, doctors, I imagine, what are they telling you when you say, hey, I think I'm going to go out and try to run a race, and, you know, if you do a 10K or whatever, what's their reaction to all of that?
They were very supportive.
Were they?
Okay. Yeah, yeah.
The doc wasn't saying, whoa.
The doctors were happy to see me out there and running. In fact, I ran one of my cardiologists' first 5Ks with him.
And all right. We ran across the finish line. Well, that's great news. And I guess if I'm a doctor, you're my patient, you're my product, and I can prove that my product is, you know, I just did a great job. The guy's out running.
Well, I mean, most heart transplants will gain 100 pounds within the first year post-transplant. That's because we become transplant-induced diabetic. So I had diabetes to contend with coming out of transplant. I beat that. And then there's people that just feel like their body's broken and they don't give it a shot. So I was able to manage my weight. I was able to go up to 165, 170, and I've been able to maintain that, and I was active. And so they used me to say, look, you don't have to gain 100 pounds and risk your transplant by adding undue stress on the heart with extra weight.
Wow, that's incredible. Obviously, you had phenomenal challenges, and obviously, you overcame all of them, it looks like. What anything that really sticks out in your mind? I mean, during a race or something, when you said, "I can't do this, I quit," or you know, what was one of those moments where you really questioned what you were doing or trying to do?
Well, for me, it was all gravy. I mean, for me, getting to the starting line was the victory, and then you know, as I got out there and I was on the course, it was always a matter of talking to my donor, talking to my heart, having a little conversation. Going, this is what we're going to try and do today. It's a little bit further than what we did yesterday. Do you think we can do this? And so far, each time I've asked my donor if they're into it, answer's always been yes. So we just keep going.
Yeah, you're one of these guys that reminds me that at every one of our Spartan races, and we don't really talk about the races much on this podcast, but at all of our races, at some point we will run past or more normally, a wounded warrior, adaptive athlete, whatever you want to, will run past me, you know, or and with one leg, no legs, one arm, whatever, and climb a rope or jump over the wall. And it's unbelievably inspirational to see that, to experience it. And you're right there in that same category. I mean, just talking to you, you know, I feel like I need to go and get like reinvigorated and reset some goals.
Well, you know what?
I'm hoping the audience is thinking the same thing.
I appreciate that. It's due to my donor. And this person who did not know me chose the last day and the worst day of their life to save my life. Yeah, insurance pays for the surgery. Right. It's up to me to earn it. You know, it's up to me every day to earn this gift that I've been given. Every single heartbeat.
Wow.
And I know I never will. But it doesn't stop me from trying.
I tell you what, you're very rarely am I kind of speechless here. I'm actually being emotional, so I'm trying not to do that on camera. That is a phenomenal story. All right, so what we like to do, and I know you can do this easily, kind of for the audience out there, give us like three takeaways, something, and you know, you kind of mentioned about taking advantage of the opportunity, but kind of bullet points like that sure. Life lessons that you've learned.
Wow. Well, I would say that at one point in my life, I had my focus was completely on work, and I had this great mantra that I thought was really cool, and it was a load of horseshit,
right.
But it was, I want to work hard enough, long enough, to make enough money to do all the things in life that money can't buy.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And I made a lot of money,
right?
But I put off life.
Yeah, That old T-shirt, he who dies with the most toys wins.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Yeah,
which is just horse hockey.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. And for me, I put off life and then I died a couple times. And I've been given this incredible chance to live. And so it's about knowing that when my head hits the pillow at night, I've done everything I possibly could within that 24-hour span to earn the gift.
Yeah, that's incredible.
You know, for me, it's just the understanding that anything can happen. Anything is possible. It's
both positive and negative, right?
Both
so you're healthy one day and then not the next.
And negative. I know, and that's something that actually you bring up a good point. And it's something that in the process of everything I've been doing, I've had a lot of friends die. Simply because they haven't maintained compliance with their medications. We have to take drugs.
These are people you've met through the years, I guess.
Years, okay. And in different events and activities. And every 12 hours, a transplant patient has to take meds to stay immunosuppressed so that our bodies don't fight the organs we've been given to stay alive. And if you don't stay compliant with that, you don't stay on this earth too very long. And if your head isn't in the game right, and if your head doesn't understand why you're here, then you don't have as much drive to be here. So it was important for me to try and help people who've been through hell, who've been through significant health challenges, learn how to take control of their life again, become more active, and allow that activity to reconnect them to their friends, to their family, and to do all the things in life. It doesn't have to be a Spartan race. It doesn't have to be an Iron Man. It doesn't have to be any of the things. It could be walking around the lake with their loved one and a dog and just enjoying life. And that is a connection to the world that is important. So I started a foundation called the Recycled Man Foundation. And what we try and Recycled Man Foundation.
Okay, I just want to make sure we got it in there a couple times.
Absolutely. And the tagline for that is fighting for a life worth fighting for.
Okay.
You didn't survive all this stuff to come out the other side and sit on your butt and watch TV all day. You have a life. Take advantage of it. Enjoy it.
Now, who do you, you're obviously, you spend time in hospitals.
Or I do.
You go out and you talk to.
I do.
Do you do anything with veterans who, a little bit different challenges, but yet still have to overcome,
you know,
health issues?
Everybody has health issues.
Yeah.
And another thing about this is that our veterans are some of our most noble and generous and courageous organ donors. And so they're saving our lives and our freedoms in their lives. And in their deaths, they're doing the same.
Well, you may have changed my, I don't say may, I'll say you have changed my point of view on the whole thing. For years, my wife said, okay, if you die, you know, on your license, you are giving away your heart, your lungs, whatever, right? And I would always say, absolutely not. I mean, I'm not an overly religious guy, but I don't know what the rules are. Mm-hmm. So when I get up there, I want to make sure I've got all my options. I want to make sure I've got everything that I left with, because I don't want somebody up there to say, you gave away what? You know, what exactly?
Wait, you needed that to get into here.
Yeah, you needed that up here just as much as you needed it down here. But I get it. That's somewhat, obviously.
Yeah. Well, thankfully, I have done a lot of research in the area. There are no major religions that oppose organ donation. In fact, all of the major religions find organ donation as the greatest gift that we can give another human being.
That's nice. Well, and I've been signed up for years. I'm just kind of making a little bit of light of it here.
Yeah.
But all right, so the three things, we're going to wrap it up here then. Correct me if I'm wrong. Take advantage of your opportunities. Earn those opportunities. Mm-hmm. And good or bad things can happen any day. Be ready. Anything's possible. Be ready for the change.
Absolutely.
All right. Listen, this was a phenomenal. I enjoyed meeting you.
Likewise.
And hearing your story.
Likewise.
Really nice. Marion, anything before we go? Okay, good.
That guy was awesome. I caught the tail end of the interview. I was there. You remember?
No, I remember. Yeah.
You guys had just finished up. And the thing I got instantly when I met him was he appreciated life. And so, you know, it takes something. I mean, that's extreme. It takes something in somebody's life to rattle them to a point where they say, you know what? I appreciate today. And I appreciate tomorrow. I appreciate every day I get on the planet. And so I picked that up right away.
Well, no, I think you're absolutely right. We've had other interviews. With our adaptive athletes, guys missing an arm or a leg or multiple appendages. But, you know, to be dead, to be flatlined twice, and then to get a heart transplant. When he was talking about having to learn to wiggle his fingers and his toes, fall off the bed, low crawl to the wall, push himself up the wall just to learn to stand, and that was a workout. And to go from that, nothing, to be able to run and compete multiple Ironman, that's just phenomenal.
Well, I think, like, for all of you guys out there, right, for me, I mean, how many of these stories do we hear where everything's possible, right? Any excuse or any challenge or anything that you're facing in your life, look at these examples. You can go from death to Ironman. So all you have to do is, like, have the fortitude and the exuberance and the positive attitude to just go for it. I mean, we've seen it so many times. The resiliency of the body is remarkable, and it's all, I think so much of it is mental.
So the thing that pisses me off about it, though, is why do we have to wait for something to happen to wake us up?
Because you're content.
You went from a hunter-gatherer society to a civilized culture once you had agricultural crops that provided everything that you needed. Then people just stayed there and ate off the land. If there's an easier way to do it, human animals, that's a grasshopper, that's pretty cool.
So but content goes back to content. People are content.
People are content. That's the nature of the human, right? It's the exceptional person like yourself, and I'm not saying that because you're
he's kind of exceptional.
He's not exceptional.
Not really. He's got a good brain.
Is exceptional,
and a kettlebell.
Is exceptional in his vision and in his drive. But what go back when you're talking about being content, the other thing is Derek was average, right? He was your average 30-year-old something guy who hadn't worked out in a while and who was overweight, who then got cancer and got sick first, and it was the chemo that then affected his heart. But he was your average everyday schmo walking down the street. So what I'm saying is you're exactly right. Anybody, it's innate. It's still in our bodies. And then what drives it out, right? And in this case, it was this. But still, he's still an exceptional guy. A lot of people aren't coming back from that.
Well, the
most.
Hang on, Sefer. The message, I guess, for folks out there is to not let it get to that. Let's go back to Nir Eyal, a previous podcast we had, right? Where he said the number one motivator for any human being is avoiding discomfort. And so if that's the fact, which makes us, we just want to be content
right?
We want to watch Netflix,
whatever
Netflix,
it is.
Whatever it is with Netflix, every night,
he doesn't
naked, right?
He doesn't
use it.
And not be uncomfortable at all. I would say what you got to do is flip the switch, change the narrative, and make it so that you're more uncomfortable if you eat the garbage food, if you don't wake up early, if you don't do the workout. For me, I just flipped the switch and said, I'm more uncomfortable if I don't do the workout, right?
I think that people, like, they always have this common paradigm that, like, oh, the cold shower. I guarantee you, if you're, like, depressed and have a bad day, for one day, try taking a cold shower and your day's like, oh my, I can't swear, but like, oh my God, my day is 100% better. You know what I mean? It's like, actually just try it. Like, instead of listening to it, just try it. And I think it's like really going to do something for you. Well, and I think
Seb is trying to say, don't wait for the heart attack. Don't wait for the heart transplant.
But there's like a way to, that complacency, there's disruptors of that, right?
Tim, was your uncle the bricklayer? Was he the guy that kind of made it feel like a heart transplant for you? Was it the military? What was it?
My uncle, that's nice of you to bring him up. No, he was a hard man, right? And he did a lot of hard things. And his view on life was always, no matter what the situation was, he was, again, much like you, would shrug and say, you know, it could be worse, right? You know, and he would always go back to the POWs in the Korean War. You know, that was his baseline, because that's what he knew about. So that was his baseline. So everything is better than that. You know, there's always somebody who has it worse. There's always a condition. You're complaining now? It could be colder. It could be raining. It could be hotter. Just shut up and get your work done.
Don't wait for the heart transplant. Don't wait for the diabetes. Just go out, get a little uncomfortable, change your perspective like your uncle did. What changed your perspective before we wrap?
I think, honestly, moving to Pittsfield, all of a sudden it became getting up at 4:30 and running 10 miles in the morning is normal. And if you don't do that, that's what your friends are doing. And it's just a paradigm shift being around a community that says, like, this is what we do. This is our healthy attitude and how we can thrive the best possible way as humans. And once you see that, it's really hard to go back into the paradigm of, like, what? Why? You know? So it's like...
So find some friends.
Putting the veil back.
Push outside your comfort zone. All right, here's a question. If you're listening, we want to know. I want to know. What is holding you back from getting uncomfortable? Because if you get a little uncomfortable, it doesn't have to be a lot. To Sefer's point, it could be 6 hours. It doesn't have to be 4 days. Or in his case, doesn't need to be a heart transplant. What's holding you back from getting uncomfortable?